and welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Wednesday, March 13th, 2024. You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. I'm your reader, Mary Francis, and all material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of folks with print disabilities. Looking at the front page for today's Sioux City Journal, we have two large stories, or actually three. First one is Youth Art Month, Budding Artists. Next article is Jail Opening Delayed to Mid-May. And the third article on the front page is State Gives $1.2 Million for Siouxland Splash Road. So we always start with the hard news. Above the fold, we have Jail Opening Delayed to Mid-May. New problems hinder Woodbury County Jail. The opening of the Woodbury County Law Enforcement Center has been delayed to mid-May, quote, due to events outside of the authority's control. The substantial completion date was set for April 9, but the Woodbury County Law Enforcement Center Authority said Tuesday that date will not be achieved. They are now proposing a completion date of mid-May. Quote, the authority now believes that due to events outside of the authority's control, the LEC will not be substantially complete by the current substantial completion date of April 9, according to an authority news release. The quote continues, this is due in part to additional mechanical work that will now have to be completed pertaining to the testing and balancing of the mechanical system, unquote. The authority states this delay is due to, quote, actions, inactions, and errors by Introba, Inc. That's an engineering consultant hired by Goldberg Group Architects. On February 7th, the authority announced a construction change directive had been issued related to, quote, certain work that will need to be performed on the mechanical system, unquote. On Tuesday, the authority approved another change directive for the issues. In Tuesday's news release, the authority states they do not agree with the costs or time associated with the mechanical work proposed by Hausman Construction, who is the general contractor. Kevin Rost with Goldberg Group Architects said a cost of approximately $79,000 was proposed. A May 23rd date has been proposed by Hausman Construction, which is the Lincoln, Nebraska-based general contractor, in documents submitted to the authority starting November 20th of 2023. Quote, that completion date isn't anything official yet. They're reserving the right for that completion date to be that, said Shane Albrecht of the Baker Group, project manager for the jail. Because of the delays and the authority's lack of confidence in Introba, the authority has hired its own mechanical, electrical, and plumbing engineer, Resource Consulting Engineers, LLC, according to the release. Quote, the authority and its counsel continue to assess its additional costs and damages on the project caused by the actions, inactions, and delays by Hausman, GGA, and GGA's mechanical engineering sub-consultant Introba, and are taking the proper steps to ultimately hold the responsible parties liable for such additional costs and damages to be incurred by the authority, unquote, according to the release. Woodbury County Sheriff Chad Sheehan said a walkthrough by Iowa Chief Jail Inspector Delbert Longley resulted in a list of corrective work needed. Quote, until those items are fixed, he cannot give us approval to open or occupy the building, Sheehan said. Longley is the only jail inspector in Iowa. Sheehan said he is expected to return sometime in mid-April or the first week of May. Worst-case scenario, Sheehan said Longley would return to Sioux City on May 8. Rost said the walkthrough process is 99% complete. We're getting closer and closer to the completion of this thing, Rost said. Sheehan expressed frustration with Sioux City news station KTIV regarding a Freedom of Information Act request that had a total cost of $11,767.50 and has been worked on by the authority's lawyer, Jody McDougall, of Frederickson and Byron, PA, since September. Sheehan said from his perspective, he understands the desire to get the information, but is frustrated with the time dedicated to it. If the time that was spent replying to some of this FOIA request was spent preparing for the state jail inspector, We may have been able to get this occupancy today, Sheehan said. A day before the September 14th deadline for contractors to finish their work, LEC leaders announced the completion date had been pushed back to a proposed April 9th date due to 38 missing fire dampers. The new jail was originally expected to be completed in March of 2023, when it was bid in 2021. It was later pushed back to August 2023, and then to September 14, 2023. Since the September delay, the authority has given regular updates on the project and ongoing work. On Tuesday, the LEC authority approved payment to Hausman for $163,365.30 for some of the work related to the 38 missing dampers. That payment is part of the proposed nearly $1.8 million in additional costs. Quote, the authority, GGA, and Hausman are continuing to discuss Hausman's previously requested additional time and expense for this damper work, with which the authority and GGA has expressed their disagreement, unquote, according to a news release. Another story from the front page, sticking with hard news. State gives $1.2 million for Siouxland Splash Road. December completion targeted for Highway 75 road work. The Iowa Transportation Commission approved more than $1.2 million in grant funding Tuesday for the construction of a roadway to support a new water park in Sioux City. The city of Sioux City will receive up to $1,250,957 to assist with the construction of approximately 410 feet of new roadway and turn lanes on Highway 75 North. The project is expected to be completed by December. Siouxland Splash, located at 3820 Highway 75, is slated to be open for business by the summer of 2025 and is under design by a team of water park consultants. Sioux City currently has several public pools and splash pads, but no water parks. Last month, the City Council approved a resolution supporting a grant application to the DOT's Revitalize Iowa's Sound Economy, or RISE, program for the construction of the roadway. An Iowa DOT review determined that turn lanes in both directions will be required to safely allow traffic to decelerate and make the turn from Highway 75, which is under the DOT's jurisdiction, to the water park. Siouxland Splash's site plan also requires a short access road connecting the entrance to the turn lanes to be built on Highway 75. The RISE program offers funding to road projects from a newly created tourism category. A local match is required from the city. The city engineer's estimate for construction of the road is $1,375,925. The estimate for the turning lanes is $1,125,988. Frontline Development LLC, a group of local investors, intends to invest an estimated $12 to $15 million to build the water park. Joe Ziering, partner and co-owner of Frontline Development LLC, previously told the council that the park will have a lazy river, a wave pool, and one of the biggest kids zones in the Midwest. Quote, we're going to have a huge slide tower with actually a really iconic slide. It's going to be the first one in the United States, he said. We're going to really try and make a big impact for Sioux City here. We want to make this a really fun staple in the community. In the big article from the front page, Budding Artists, Sioux City Art Center exhibit features 79 works by elementary school students. And it shows a photograph of the exhibition, and there are a number of items framed on the wall, looking like 10. And then in the foreground is a table, and it has a couple of three-dimensional sculpture-type items on it. The exhibition runs through April 21. Kim Albracht, that's A-L-B-R-A-C-H-T, never misses a 10 to 15-minute walk through the children's exhibition when she visits a museum. The sight of the bright colors and animals that she often sees in the budding artist's works make her happy. Albrecht, who serves as the Sioux City Art Center's education coordinator, hopes members of the public do the same during Youth Art Month. That's a nationwide recognition and celebration of quality primary and secondary school art education. The 35th annual YAM, or Youth Art Month, at the Art Center, which is located at 225 Nebraska Street, features 79 artworks created by students in grades K through 5. You'll see self-portraits in the style of Pablo Picasso, drawings of the family pet, pumpkins that seem to pop off the paper, and vibrant landscapes. The exhibit runs through April 21. Quote, "Any type of showing support to youth about making art shows that there's value in what they're doing, not just displaying something on the refrigerator for a week, but giving it a prominent place and emphasizing the buildup of self-esteem in these kids," Albrecht said. Elementary art teachers from Sioux City and neighboring communities in Iowa and Nebraska submitted 518 entries to the Art Center. Then, Thomas Wharton, assistant professor of art at Briarcliff University, made the selections via a blind jurying process. All of the entries were laid out on tables by grade. Wharton wasn't aware of the student, school, or teacher associated with each artwork. Albrecht said, "The show has a little bit of everything, from chalk pastel drawings to mixed media collages to clay sculptures. Color is prominent." Quote, "We know that the teachers are working with them on certain elements of art, so you can really look at some of these pieces and make a pretty good guess that they're talking about color or they're talking about line, form, or value," she said. "Color is such a big one at this grade level. There is so much color happening in a lot of these pieces. As a personal viewer of art, that's something that I enjoy. I get drawn in," she said. Nyakan Kuol's Ted Harrison-inspired landscape is one of those vibrant pieces that Albrecht is drawn to. The chalk pastel piece, created by Nyakan, who's a student at Cluckholm Elementary in Lamars, was awarded second place among third graders. Ted Harrison, a British-Canadian painter, was known for his colorful paintings of the Yukon landscape. This year's Best in Show went to Schleswig Community School Kindergarten Beau Hedstrom for his crayon and watercolor piece entitled Fall Colors. "I think he just enjoyed the color of it, everything that was going on, the different techniques that were used," Albrecht said of why Wharton selected Beau's piece. "I think for this juror, having a finished piece was important to him." Several artworks featuring pumpkins were submitted, but second grader Shydale Jones and third grader Charlotte Howcap's pieces were chosen for the exhibit. Both students attend Perry Creek Elementary School in Sioux City. Jones' mixed media artwork earned her a second place honor among the second grade entries. Quote, "They're all working on the same thing, but we see that the one that makes it into the show has something that goes above and beyond," Albrecht said. YAM began as Children's Art Month in 1961. It was renamed Youth Art Month in 1969 to promote the value of art education for all K through 12 students. Events such as the Art Center's YAM exhibition encourages public support for art education programs in local schools and communities. And turning to the second page, which is titled Local, it shows a photo of the Liberty National Bank, and the headline there is North Sioux City Bank Robbery Suspect Arrested. A Sioux City man was arrested Tuesday on suspicion of robbing a North Sioux City bank. North Sioux City Police Chief Richard Hayded said the suspect walked into Liberty National Bank at 113 Military Road at 2:43 p.m. and handed a teller a note that demanded money or someone would be hurt. The suspect also displayed a knife. The robber left the bank with $1,000 to $5,000 in cash, walked to a nearby parking lot where he got into a car and took off. Police followed the suspect into Sioux City, where Hayded said he pulled in front of the suspect's car and forced him to stop near West 19th and John Streets. The suspect was taken into custody without incident, and the stolen money was recovered. Hayded said Dennis Manchester, age 44, was arrested on charges of first-degree robbery, aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, grand theft, and driving while suspended. Hayden said Manchester will be in jail, or will be held rather in the Woodbury County Jail, until he can be extradited to South Dakota to face charges. No bank employees were injured, he said. Next story, 16-year-old charged with harassment, allegedly tried to lure 10-year-old into vehicle. Sioux City police say a 16-year-old has been charged with harassment for allegedly offering a 10-year-old girl candy from a vehicle. In a Monday Facebook post, the Sioux City Police Department reported that at 5:45 p.m. Saturday, a woman attempted to get a 10-year-old girl into a silver Ford Bronco in the 4500 block of Cheyenne Boulevard. The department shared a video of the incident in an effort to identify the occupants of the vehicle and determine whether there was a danger to the public. A report about the incident was made to the department on Sunday. The driver of the Bronco was initially described as a white female believed to be in her early 20s. Quote, the female offered the juvenile candy and then backed up and made comments about the juvenile's shoes, the department said in a statement issued Monday evening. A juvenile suspect, the statement continues, who was an occupant of the vehicle, saw the video and contacted the Sioux City Police Department. A 16-year-old juvenile female has been charged with harassment. The statement said the department encourages parents to have open conversations with their children about staying safe and understanding stranger danger. Anyone with information related to similar incidents are encouraged to contact the department at 712-279-6440, or you can call the anonymous tip line, which is 712-258-TIPS. Our next story, Sioux City School Board okays gym air conditioning. The Sioux City School Board approved two projects on Monday. The projects are installing air conditioning at the three high school gyms and ventilation improvements at the Harry Hopkins Trades Facility. The board also approved the purchase of air conditioning equipment for the high schools. The school district has to use its remaining elementary and secondary school emergency relief funds, also known by the acronym ESSER, by June 30. The board voted unanimously to approve the plans, specifications, and estimated costs of both projects and to set public hearings. Each Sioux City High School will receive rooftop air conditioning units for its gym to provide both heating and air conditioning, as well as humidity control, according to board documents. Currently, there is no air conditioning in any of the Sioux City High School gyms. Monday, the board approved the purchase of equipment for the air conditioning project for $912,240. Bids for installation will be taken at a later date, according to board documents. The total cost is estimated to be $3.54 million. Tim Paul, the district's operations and maintenance director, said part of the project will be covered by approximately $2.3 million of ESSER funds, while the rest will be covered by the sales tax funds. The welding program at the Harry Hopkins facility will receive 24 new welding bays, each with a downdraft welding table providing ventilation at each location. There will also be an ambient air unit for dust particles in the auto body shop and a hood exhaust system over the plasma cutter, according to board documents. The total cost for that is estimated to be $225,000. The district plans to purchase the units directly from the vendor and bid for installation costs at a later date. Paul said there will be minimal installation required. It will be completed by June 30th. And in brief, man injured in I-29 crash in Monona County, Dateline Whiting, Iowa. A Sioux Falls man was seriously injured late Monday after his parked car was struck by a truck on Interstate 29 near Whiting. According to the Iowa State Patrol, David Martinez was stopped in his Honda Accord with no lights on in the right lane of southbound I-29 near mile marker 118 at 10:09 p.m. David Chumbly of Halbert, Iowa, was southbound in an international truck when he saw Martinez's vehicle and swerved in an attempt to avoid it. The truck struck the car, pushing it off the highway and into the ditch. Martinez, age 45, was airlifted to the University of Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha. Chumbly, age 53, was not injured, the State Patrol said. Three other vehicles were damaged by debris from the crash. And here's an article from Health. I don't want to be on them forever. Weight loss drugs like Wegovy are meant for long-term use. Some patients want to stop. And it shows a large photo of a woman with a white cat. She's reaching over to pet her cat on the head. And the caption is, Donna Cooper pets her cat Cade in her home in Front Royal, Virginia. This is from the Associated Press. Millions of Americans who dropped pounds and boosted their health using popular obesity drugs like Wegovy are facing a new dilemma. What happens if they stop taking them? Many worry, rightly, that they'll regain weight and return to old habits. In clinical trials, patients who pause the drugs put back on most of the weight that they lost, but others are gambling on a do-it-yourself strategy to ease off the drugs and stay slim by stretching out doses, taking the medication intermittently, or stopping and starting again only if needed. Quote, to me, it's a help. It's an aid, said Donna Cooper, age 62, of Front Royal, Virginia, who lost nearly 40 pounds in 9 months using Wegovy along with diet and exercise. At some point, you have to come off of them. I don't want to be on them forever, she said. More than 3 million prescriptions for the new medications are dispensed each month in the U.S., according to recent data from the health technology company IQVIA. They include semaglutide, which is the drug in Ozempic and Wegovy, and tirzepatide, the drug in Mounjaro and Zepbound. But many people don't stick with it. One recent study published in the journal Obesity found that just 40% of patients who filled a prescription for Wegovy in 2021 or 2022 were still taking it a year later. Doctors who treat obesity stress that the disease is a chronic condition that must be managed indefinitely, like heart disease or high blood pressure. The new injection drugs work by mimicking hormones in the gut and the brain to regulate appetite and feelings of fullness. They were designed and tested to be taken continuously, experts say. We're not an injection shop, said Dr. Andre Acosta, who is an obesity researcher and medical advisor at the Mayo Clinic. I don't think they should be used in an intermittent fashion. It's not approved for that. They don't work like that. Despite that directive, some patients who achieved their health and weight goals with the drugs are looking for an off-ramp, said Dr. Amy Rothberg, who is a University of Michigan endocrinologist who directs a weight management and diabetes treatment program. Quote, many of them want to step down or de-escalate their dose, she said, and they're also wanting to ultimately discontinue the medication. Unquote. The reasons for pausing the drugs can vary, said Dr. Catherine Saunders, who is an obesity expert at Weill Cornell Medicine and co-founder of the obesity treatment company called IntelliHealth. Some patients don't like the side effects such as nausea and constipation. Others want to stop for holidays or special occasions, or just because they don't want to take the weekly shots indefinitely. One of Saunders' patients, a 53-year-old New York man, lost 70 pounds last year using Mounjaro. He told Saunders that he wanted to take a breather from the medication to see how his body reacted. On her advice, he's been stretching out injections to every 10 days or 2 weeks instead of weekly since December. Other patients have been forced to ration or halt doses because the drugs are costly, $1,000 to $1,300 a month, and insurance coverage varies, or because demand has far outstripped supply, Rothberg noted. It's being imposed on them, she said. By necessity, they have to go off the medication and kind of figure it out. But hoping the drug's benefits will last even after stopping them ignores the fundamental biology of obesity, experts say. The disease affects the way the body processes and stores energy, causing it to accumulate weight. The new drugs alter that process, and when patients stop, the disease returns, often with a vengeance. Many people dropping off the medications report a sharp rise in symptoms of obesity. They include so-called food noise or intrusive thoughts of food, raging hunger, and decreased feelings of fullness when they eat. These drugs are just a super suppressor of these native signals, Rothberg said, and we should expect that's going to occur. Tara Rothenhofer, age 48, of Trinity, Florida, lost more than 200 pounds after joining a clinical trial for Mounjaro nearly 4 weeks ago. She now takes the lowest dose of the drug every 4 to 8 weeks, but worries about when her weight fluctuates by a few pounds. It scares the daylights out of me to see the numbers on the scale going up, she said. Some patients who stop the drugs and start again find they cannot tolerate the medication, winding up with severe gastrointestinal side effects, Acosta said. Others find the drugs don't work as well when they restart them, Saunders added, but there's no data on the long-term effects of intermittent use. Quote, I don't think it's a strategy that will work for most individuals, but it could be an option for select patients, Saunders said. Cooper has heard that people gain back weight when they stop the drugs, but she hopes to be an exception. She's on her last box of Wegovy injections. Once she's done, Cooper said she'll just continue with a strict diet and exercise plan. I just needed a crutch to get everything back in order, she said, who's gone from a size 16 to a size 10, and I'm excited to be done, she said. And now we'll turn to obituaries. Mary Ann Berg, age 92, of Sioux City, died Saturday, March 9th. Memorial service, Thursday, March 14th, 10 a.m. at the Calvary Lutheran Church. Visitation, today, Wednesday, 5 to 7 p.m. at the Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Jeanette Burnite obituary, Jeanette Ann Burnite. Jeanette of Sioux City died on Friday, March 8th at the age of 97. Funeral services, Thursday, March 14th, 11 a.m. at the Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel, with Reverend Christine Steggy of First Lutheran Church officiating. Interment will follow at the Memorial Park Cemetery. Visitation with the family present will begin at 9:30 a.m. Thursday prior to the service at the funeral home. Memorials may be directed to the Holy Family Food Pantry at First Lutheran Church in Sioux City. Jeanette was born September 15th, 1926, the daughter of Louis and Mina Mary Mikulowski Staszewski, Staszewski. She attended Sioux City Public Schools, graduated from East High School in 1944. It was at East High School that she met the love of her life, Raymond Burnite. He was a standout football player, and she was an enthusiastic cheerleader. Separated during his service in the South Pacific Theater during World War II, Jeanette worked at Western Union typing telegrams. Ray and Jeanette were married at First Lutheran Church in Sioux City, November 29, 1947. Jeanette's many interests and volunteer activities kept her always on the go. A number of First Lutheran Church in Sioux City, a member rather, she was a Sunday school and Bible school teacher and served faithfully on the Altar Guild for many years. She served as a den mother for both her sons' Boy Scout troops for several years and raised 2 Eagle Scouts. She was an accomplished artist and poet, a skilled cook and homemaker. She always had a craft project underway, and her holiday dinner tables were a work of art. No one ever left her house hungry. She enjoyed golf and bowling, playing on several local leagues, and she collected many trophies. In addition to her many other activities, Jeanette held several positions outside the home. Over the years, she worked at Sears, Linda Lee's, Willage's clothing store, and also at State Finance Company, where she put her bookkeeping skills to good use. She was a longtime member of the Eastern Star, receiving her 50-year pin. Some of her fondest memories were those she created marching and traveling with her friends in the Daughters of the Nile, for which she served as Supreme Queen of Hathor Temple in 1987 and 1988. She was a member of the Iota Delphinian Study Group, the Girls of 44, and a longtime member of the PEO. Jeanette loved to dance and never wanted to miss an episode of Dancing with the Stars. She and Ray belonged to a dance club for several years. She was an active member of the Happy Hoofers Tap Dancing Troupe and loved to perform at local athletic halftime shows and dance contests even into her late 80s. Jeanette loved to travel, particularly cruising. Avid boaters, she and Ray were members of the Missouri River Boat Club from its inception. With friends and family, they sailed the Missouri and Mississippi rivers from Chamberlain, South Dakota to New Orleans on the Jeannie, that was their boat that they named for her. And her services again for Jeanette Burnight will be Thursday, March 14th at the Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel. Jeremy Patrick Doucette, that's D-O-U-C-E-T-T-E, age 46 of Mobile, passed away Monday, February 12th in Cedar Rapids. Celebration of life, Sunday, March 17, 1 to 4 p.m. at the Mobile Community Center in Mobile. Gosler Funeral Home and Monuments of Onawa are handling the arrangements. Luann Lundy Goebel, age 68, passed away Saturday, February 24, in Alexandria, Minnesota. Luann was born July 27, 1955, in Sioux City, to Lewis and Wilma Lundy. She grew up in Sioux City and attended Sioux City schools. After graduating high school, she attended Iowa State University and Morningside College. After college, she worked for many years at the Sioux City Public Libraries while raising her son Lewis. While working, she met her husband, Mark Goebel. They were married in Sioux City in the year 2000. They moved to Des Moines in 2001 and subsequently to St. Cloud, Minnesota. They moved to Alexandria, Minnesota in 2010, where she lived for the remainder of her life, making many dear friends. She loved her family and her friends. She loved shopping and rides in the country. Fall was her favorite season. She loved animals, especially her cats, Sammy and Midnight, preceded in death by her parents, Lou and Wilma, and her brother, Dan. Left to cherish her memory are her husband, Mark, her son, Louis, and wife, Kimmy, her brother, Jim, and six grandchildren. A gathering of remembrance will be held at the VFW in Alexandria, Minnesota, on Thursday, March 14th, from 2 to 4 p.m. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made in her name to the Outreach Food Shelf in Alexandria or to a charity of the giver's choice. Carolyn Parker Jacobson, age 75, passed away March 7th. Memorial service will be Saturday, March 16th, 10:30 a.m. at the Christy Smith Funeral Home in Morningside, with visitation 1 hour prior to that service, so at 9:30. Leslie Les Lee Jones, age 74, of Whiting, died Friday, March 8th. Services, Saturday, March 16th, 10 a.m., at the Gosler Funeral Home Chapel in Onawa. Burial will follow in the Onawa Cemetery with military honors. Gosler Funeral Home and Monuments in Onawa is handling the arrangements. And here's an opinion from the London Guardian. The Russian opposition needs help amid sham election. Article 13 of the Russian Constitution promises political pluralism. Article 29 guarantees freedom of speech. It's a brave citizen who insists on those rights. Though Russia will hold a presidential election at the end of this week, the result is a foregone conclusion. Vladimir Putin will win comfortably. The spirit of post-Soviet democratization is all but dead. The flame is kept alive by a courageous few. Thousands turned out at the Moscow funeral of Alexei Navalny, the jailed opposition leader generally assumed to have been murdered by order of the Kremlin. Chants called for Russia without Putin. That is a high-risk activity. Open dissent against the regime is punishable by fines and prison sentences. OVD-Info, which is a human rights group, has cataloged hundreds of detentions in dozens of cities after vigils in honor of Navalny. It's been the largest show of opposition since the invasion of Ukraine, but the numbers are not huge for a country of 144 million. What the majority of Russians think about their president and his war is opaque. Opinion polls show majorities in favor of both, but it's hard to conduct accurate surveys in a climate where deviation from the official line is legally prescribed. Independent analysts say the picture is nuanced, a spectrum of sentiment with ideological pro-Kremlin conviction shading into looser patriotic sympathy with the army, and then degrees of apathy, low-level discontent, grim resignation, despair, and a kernel of committed anti-regime activists. Putin's position is secured by brute force and cultivated disbelief that any alternative is viable. He achieves this by eliminating rivals and propagating a personality cult that depicts Russia as the target of a foreign dismemberment plot and himself as the only person able to hold the country together. This speaks to a deep-rooted national anxiety about the motherland unraveling in chaos. Something like that happened recently enough, for older generations in particular, to see that democracy is a risk not worth taking. This week's election is not meant to fool anyone into thinking that Russians have a choice. It's a ritual affirmation of incumbent power, a pastiche of democracy to demoralize those who dream of peaceful regime change. But even the pretense of a ballot gives the opposition something to rally around. Yulia Navalnaya, the murdered descendant's widow, has called for anti-Putin voters to converge on polling stations at midday on Sunday, even if they don't intend to vote. The point is to be visible. The authorities can hardly ban such gatherings when they are laying on the election. These are wholly symbolic gestures, but that doesn't mean that they are futile. Russians who dare to speak up for democracy and those who silently crave the end of Putin need reminding that they are not alone. There is a role also for those outside Russia who can amplify voices of courage and hope. Jailed opposition figures Ilya Yashin and Vladimir Kara Mirza risk suffering the same fate as Navalny. The more conspicuous their plight, the harder it is for Putin to pretend his is the only vision of Russian politics. The freedoms that are promised in Russia's constitution feel remote today, as this week's election will sadly demonstrate. But it will also show that the spirit of opposition cannot be extinguished. And that was an opinion from the London Guardian. That is the end of all the local news in the Sioux City Journal. Now we'll turn to the Nation and World page. Panel hears from her. Transcript, Biden said he didn't intentionally take information home. This is from the Associated Press. Lawmakers turned a Tuesday hearing on President Joe Biden's handling of classified documents into a proxy battle between the Democratic president and Republican frontrunner Donald Trump, as a newly released transcript of Biden's testimony last fall showed that he repeatedly insisted he never meant to retain classified information after he left the vice presidency. Special counsel Robert Hur, testifying for more than 4 hours before the House Judiciary Committee, stood steadfastly by the assessments of his 345-page report that questioned Biden's age and competence, but recommended no criminal charges for the president, finding insufficient evidence to make a case that will stand up in court. Quote, what I wrote is what I believe the evidence shows and what I expect jurors would perceive and believe, Hur said. I did not sanitize my explanation, nor did I disparage the president unfairly, unquote. The transcript of hours of interviews between Biden and the special counsel, released Tuesday, provide a more textured picture of the investigation, filling in some of the gaps left by hers and Biden's accounting of the exchanges. While Biden was adamant that he treated classified information seriously, the transcript shows that he said he was unfamiliar with the paper trail for some of the sensitive documents that he handled. The hearing played out as both Biden and Trump were on the cusp of claiming their party's nominations, and the party lines calcified almost immediately over which leader, quote-unquote, willfully retained classified documents and who didn't. Republicans argued Biden was being given a pass by his own Justice Department and that Trump was unfairly victimized by prosecutors. Democrats, for their part, stressed Biden's cooperation in the investigation and strongly contrasted that with the separate criminal case against Trump, who refused to return classified documents after it was requested by the National Archives at his Florida estate. Biden's team returned the documents after they were discovered, and the president cooperated with the investigation by voluntarily sitting for an interview and consenting to searches of his homes. Trump, by contrast, is accused of enlisting the help of aides and lawyers to conceal the documents from the government and seeking to have potentially incriminating evidence destroyed. Her was the rare witness vilified all around by Republicans angry over his decision not to charge the president and by Democrats for his unflattering commentary about President Biden. Next national story shows a group of people leaning over a fence, and they're holding containers like coffee cans and plastic tubs. And it says Palestinians line up for a meal Tuesday in Rafah at the Gaza Strip, and many of the people who are holding out tubs are children. Ship stocked with aid sets sail. The charity mission is separate from U.S. plans to build a floating dock. As an aid ship loaded with some 200 tons of food set sail for Gaza on Tuesday in a pilot program for the opening of a sea corridor to the territory, where the five-month-old Israel-Hamas war has driven hundreds of thousands of Palestinians to the brink of starvation. The push to get food in by sea, along with a recent campaign of airdrops into isolated northern Gaza, highlighted the international community's frustration with the growing humanitarian crisis and its inability to get aid in by road. The food on the aid ship was collected by the World Central Kitchen Charity and is being transported by the Spanish aid group Open Arms. The ship departed from Cyprus and is expected to arrive in Gaza in 2 to 3 days. The U.S. has separately announced plans to construct a floating dock near Gaza to deliver aid, but it'll likely be weeks before it is operational. 4 U.S. Army boats with equipment and steel pier segments left Virginia on Tuesday, headed to Gaza. President Joe Biden's administration has provided military aid for Israel while urging it to facilitate more humanitarian access. The war, triggered by Hamas's October 7th attack on Israel, has killed more than 30,000 Palestinians and driven most of Gaza's 2.3 million people from their homes. A quarter of Gaza's population is starving, according to the United Nations. The U.S., Qatar, and Egypt tried to broker a ceasefire and hostage release ahead of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, which began at sundown on Sunday. The talks stalled as Hamas demanded any temporary pause in the fighting come with guarantees for ending the war. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vows to expand the offensive into the Strip's southern city of Rafah, where half of Gaza's population has sought refuge, and to keep fighting until Hamas is dismantled. Aid groups say it's nearly impossible to deliver aid in much of Gaza because of Israeli restrictions, ongoing hostilities, and the breakdown of order. 6 trucks brought humanitarian aid directly into hard-hit northern Gaza on Tuesday evening, coordinated by the Israeli military, which called it a pilot program. Pentagon to seek $300 million in weapons to Ukraine. This is from the Associated Press. The Pentagon will rush about $300 million in weapons to Ukraine after finding some cost savings in its contracts, the White House said Tuesday, though the military remains deeply overdrawn and needs at least $10 billion to replenish the weapons it pulled from its stocks to help Kiev in its fight against Russia. It's the Pentagon's first announced security package for Ukraine since December, when it acknowledged it was out of replenishment funds. It wasn't until recent days that officials publicly acknowledged they weren't just out of replenishment funds, but $10 billion overdrawn. The announcement comes as Ukraine is running low on munitions and efforts to get fresh funds for weapons stalled in the House because of Republican opposition. Iowa Democrats launched a long-shot effort Tuesday to force a vote on $95 billion in aid for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, intensifying pressure on Republican Speaker Mike Johnson to take up the foreign funding package. For their petition to trigger action in the House, it must be signed by a majority of lawmakers or 218 members. U.S. inflation up again as prices remain elevated. From the Associated Press, consumer prices in the United States picked up last month, a sign that inflation remains a persistent challenge for the Federal Reserve and for President Joe Biden's reelection campaign, both of which are counting on a steady easing of price pressures this year. Prices rose 0.4% from January to February. That's higher than the previous month's figure of 0.3%, the Labor Department said Tuesday. Compared with a year earlier, consumer prices rose 3.2% last month, above January's 3.1% annual pace. Excluding volatile food and energy prices, so-called core prices also climbed 0.4% from January to February, matching the previous month's rise. Core inflation is watched closely because it typically provides a better read of where inflation is likely headed. In a State of the Union speech last week, Biden criticized many large companies for engaging in price gouging and shrinkflation, in which a company shrinks the amount of product rather than raising the price. Too many corporations raise prices to pad their profits, charging more and more for less and less, Biden said. In the Nation and World Digest, Haiti's prime minister to resign amid violence. Politicians across Haiti scrambled for power after Prime Minister Ariel Henry announced on Tuesday that he would resign once a transitional presidential council is created. Powerful gangs, which control 80% of Haiti's capital and demand a say in the future of the troubled country, are elbowing their way into the race. More than 200 gangs are estimated to operate around Haiti, mostly in Port-au-Prince and surrounding areas. They use kidnapping ransoms to buy smuggled weapons, including machine guns and sniper rifles, to overpower underfunded police. No one mentioned the armed groups as Caribbean leaders congratulated themselves late Monday for setting Haiti on a new political path. Experts warned that nothing will change unless gangs are part of the conversation. Our next brief, court extends pause on Texas migrant law. The U.S. Supreme Court extended a pause Tuesday on a Texas law that would allow police to arrest migrants accused of crossing into the country illegally as federal and state officials prepare for a showdown over immigration enforcement authority. Justice Samuel Alito ordered the hold on the law extended until Monday. That gives the court an extra week to consider what opponents call the most extreme attempt by a state to police immigration since an Arizona law that was partially struck down by the Supreme Court in 2012. U.S. District Judge David Ezra rejected the law last month, calling it unconstitutional and brushing off Texas Republicans' claims of an invasion on the southern border. An appeals court stayed that ruling, and the Justice Department asked the Supreme Court to intervene. And then in briefly, public health. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said Tuesday it will expand a program that asks international passengers to volunteer to be tested for COVID-19 and other infectious diseases, adding two more airports, Chicago O'Hare and Miami. The program already operates at six other U.S. airports. University. The New York Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit announced Tuesday over Columbia University's decision last fall to suspend two student groups that protested Israel's conduct in the Gaza war. Poland. President Duda used a joint White House visit with his, or Polish President Duda used a joint White House visit with his political rival, Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk, on Tuesday to call on NATO allies to boost defense spending and press Washington to break its impasse over replenishing funds for Ukraine. House. U.S. Representative Ken Buck, Republican of Colorado, said on Tuesday that he'll resign next week, narrowing the Republicans' razor-thin House majority and potentially throwing an obstacle in the way of Representative Lauren Boebert's effort to succeed him. Discrimination. The Utah Department of Corrections came under fire Tuesday for discriminating against a transgender inmate who the Justice Department said was driven to harm herself after she was repeatedly denied hormone therapy in violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act. In Russia, a Russian military transport plane with 15 people on board crashed Tuesday while taking off from a base in western Russia, the defense ministry said. It did not say whether there were any survivors. We'll finish with a bit of nutrition. Reader questions on granola and probiotics. This is from Barbara Intermill. We're out horse camping in the hill country of Texas, and since this is our second year here with horses and dogs in tow, we are officially what locals here call winter Texans, at least for the next few weeks. We're off the grid, but not really. We have electricity and running water. Woohoo! And we are surviving without television and cell service, unless we walk to the top of the hill. So I think this week is a good one to answer some letters from our readers. Sue from Nebraska writes, I tried the granola bar recipe you put in the Lincoln Star Journal. I cut the recipe in half. The only thing I changed was pure olive oil instead of canola oil. I cooked them at the proper temperature and time, but when I tried to cut it, they pretty much crumbled. So I now use it in yogurt treats. Just wondering what I did wrong. Doesn't sound like you did anything wrong, Sue, except the recipe was for granola, not granola bars. So yes, it should be crumbly. Brian, also from Lincoln, asks, can you please provide some trusted clinical studies, books, or journals that have to do with how pre- and probiotics are not destroyed by stomach acids or shelf life in order to actually be useful for improved gut biome health? What is a best practice for the amounts and types of live organisms? I'm not sure anyone has all the answers to your questions, Brian. One of the reasons is that the number of bacteria, good and bad, that reside in our digestive tracts probably exceeds the national debt. To discover the trillions of these microorganisms, species and strain, is best for each individual health condition is extremely tricky. Plus, each of us has a unique collection of these various organisms. It's important to know that the product you swallow is going to still be alive after it makes its way through our digestive tract. You can begin by checking the number of colony-forming units, or live organisms, that a product contains. Look for brands that have research to back them up for the specific reason you're looking for. Activia probiotic yogurt, for example, provides more than 18 clinical studies to back up the specific culture used in their products marketed for digestive health. Remember, too, that we can find these good substances in our diet. Probiotics survive on prebiotics, substances found in the fiber portion of the foods we eat. So these prebiotic fermentable fibers feed the probiotic beneficial bacteria in our guts, and everyone is happy. Foods with beneficial bacteria, probiotics, include yogurt, kefir, sauerkraut, tempeh, and kimchi. Good sources of fermentable fibers, those are prebiotics, include dried beans and other legumes, garlic, asparagus, onions, leeks, and other plant foods. That was from Barbara Intermill, a registered dietitian. And that's all the time we have for the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Wednesday, March 13th, 2024. You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. We're so glad to have you listening. Thanks, and have a wonderful day.